4 to 5 years, all we can initially say when we meet people, whether or not it's in a business situation, whether or not it's in a social situation, all we can really say is that the person appears to be nice, appears to be smart, appears to be respectful, and that we have to, even though, again, it's not romantic or sexy, we have to play out the assessment formula. And in that way, we are going to keep ourselves safe. And many people say, well, how long does it really take to do a good assessment? Well, my research found is that it takes about a year using the formula, using the 10-step formula to really find out who somebody is and isn't. And I'm not talking about running away from problems, even though, you know, people will say, well, what are some of the most important ingredients that really make or break relationships? And my answer, of course, is emotional communication and problem solving, so that there are many, many different things that we have to look at. Many different ingredients will have to be present in our relationships, if our relationships, our business relationships, our romantic relationships, our friend relationships, if they are to succeed. And in that way, again, we are going to keep ourselves hopefully really safe. What are some of the other things that I do when I'm not hosting the Speedy Show? Well, I'm the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach. I write 2 Speedy columns every single month. And you can actually read the columns if you don't happen to be in the Hamptons or you don't happen to be in Palm Beach. You're actually able to read all of my columns, and it's going to be going on to 2 years in September, so that there are many Speedy columns that I think you would probably really enjoy. So you can just go online, and it's Speedy Dan's Papers. And well, I'm also a national speaker, and I've been an expert guest on national radio and television for many years. And of course, that was the beginning when the book came out. And, you know, people will say to me, oh, you seem like you were such a natural. Trust me, I was not a natural, and I had to do a lot of work. And we all have to do a lot of work in our lives, whether it's learning about relationships, whether it's learning about crafts, if we are going to really excel. And there aren't any shortcuts. We need to be committed. We need to be motivated. And that's really the primary reason why I love to host the Ask Beattie Show. I want to try, hopefully, every single show and inspire and motivate you to be and become the very best that you can be. So then the show is really all about empowerment. What do we need to do to empower ourselves in the various facets of our lives? So, of course, we talk about relationships, and we talk about mental health, and we talk about sexuality, and again, what and how we need to do. And do is an action word, and do is the key to maximize our physical and our emotional well-being. So for those of you who've been listening to me for all these years, you know that I have a mantra, and the mantra is to be willing to be serious, to be willing to acknowledge, address, and resolve as best as we can the things that get in the way of our life and our relationships, understanding, of course, that we cannot change our history. And it's also a reminder. This is something that I think we all have to remind ourselves, is to say no to the things, the people, and places that actually steal our joy. And this is why every single week I have a how are you doing segment. And I really want you to honestly evaluate how you are doing in the various different areas of life, beginning with mental health. And how is your mental health generally? And are you generally happy with your life and relationships and the general direction that you're going in? Or have you experienced bouts of depression and anxiety and other psychiatric issues that are really getting in the way of your life and your relationship? And again, the most important question is, are you willing to do something about it? You know, I had a new patient yesterday, and I think that she may be listening to the show right now, and it was great. She actually wanted to come into my office in New York City in person. And of course, you know, I started to do my initial evaluation and asking about her family of origin and what it was like growing up in her home, and asked her about previous therapy. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, look, she said, I guess I wasn't ready because I really wasn't open with my therapist. And I kind of maybe didn't lie, but I really avoided answering the, I'm sure there were really important questions that were being asked. But yesterday, this woman was ready and is ready. So even though we've only had one session, she's going to be coming back and I'm hopefully going to be able to get the whole story and really begin to understand what she needs to do. Of course, we all need coaches in our lives, not just sport coaches, but what she's going to need to do, again, to really improve the quality of her life and her relationship. And I know that it takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of courage to ask for help. And yet, what are the alternatives if we are struggling? If we are struggling with our mental health issues, if we are struggling with our relationships? You know, I was watching the Wimbledon tennis finals, Alcaraz and Djokovic. I mean, amazing, amazing, amazing tennis. And many of you know that I was number 10 in Canada as a junior, and I would like to think that I'm probably playing the best tennis of my life, but I have a great coach, and my husband, Jim, is a great supporter on the sidelines as he watches me go through, you know, my tennis games every single week. And that's the point. We all need coaches. When I was looking at Alcaraz and Djokovic's, their boxes, they have their mental health person and they have their physical person and then they have their regular coach. And Hillary Clinton, she was right. She was really right that it takes a village. It really takes a village to sustain all of us so that we don't, and this is something that I've been saying for years, that we don't need to navigate life's ups and downs on our own. And if you are not lucky enough to have family, and if you are not lucky enough to have friends who could really support you through various different crises and ages and stages in life, then you have an option. You have an option, and that is to reach out and find yourself a really good therapist. And again, you have to be so careful who you choose, not only as a lover or as a romantic partner or a serious, perhaps, spouse, but we have to be very, very careful when choosing our doctors and our lawyers and our accountants and our therapists. I have seen and I have witnessed absolute horror stories with people who've ended up in so-called therapy, with people who have done an incredible an incredible amount of damage. So please, if you are looking for a therapist, don't just go online and look at the stars and look at the reviews. The very, very best thing that you can do is to get a referral from somebody that you actually trust, either somebody that has had a really good experience with this person or a doctor, somebody who has worked with this therapist and understands whether or not the connection, because the connection and the chemistry is also really, really important. You know, for example, if somebody is wanting to come to therapy and they are not wanting to have an interactional kind of a therapeutic experience, I would be the exact wrong person for that patient who only wanted to talk and only wanted to hear themselves express their own feelings about what was going on or not going on in their life. So moving forward in the how are you doing segment, what about substance abuse? Are you concerned? Are you concerned at all? You know, I have a patient that I'm working with, and he is absolutely convinced that he does not have a substance abuse problem. And the reality is that every single weekend he gets very, very, very drunk, and he mixes that with a variety of different kinds of drugs, including marijuana, and says to me, "But listen, Beatty, I work perfectly, perfectly well during the week. On the weekends, I just want to hang out and I just want to relax." But the fact is that this has been his MO for many, many, many years, and it's clearly affecting not only his physical health, but is obviously really connecting and affecting his marriage as well. And, you know, when we're talking about substance abuse, there was a piece in the New York Times talking about how substance abuse is really climbing amongst seniors. And I just want to, you know, quote you something here. When a Dr. Benjamin Hahn, a geriatrician and addiction medical specialist, meets new patients at the School of Medicine at the University of California in San Diego, he talks with him, obviously, about the usual health issues that older adults face, the chronic conditions, the functional ability, the medications, and how they're working. He also asks about their use of tobacco and alcohol and marijuana and other non-prescription drugs, because patients tend to not want to disclose this, but he understands it's important. I mean, how do you get a complete picture of somebody who is coming to see a doctor or coming to see a therapist if you are not open and willing to ask the really, really tough questions? Because until a few years ago, even as the opiate epidemic raged, healthcare providers and cognitive impairment were most likely exacerbated by the use of these drugs. And yet, healthcare providers and researchers paid limited attention to drug use by older adults. And the concerns primarily at that time really focused on the younger, working age people who were actually hit the hardest. So again, these are the kinds of things that we in the mental health and we in the health professions, we have to be very, very, very cognizant. And yet, look at what happens. And I was thinking about this today. I have an eye infection, so I had to see my ophthalmologist. And fortunately, I have a really, really good ophthalmologist who takes more than just 2 or 5 minutes in assessing, what was going on with my eye. And yet, these days, you go to see a doctor, and you are lucky. You are lucky, first of all, if the doctor is on time. And you are doubly lucky if the doctor is willing to take the time to ask the tough questions, not just the presenting problems. I mean, the presenting problems, the chronic problems, the headaches, the infections, etc., may be what brought you in, but there are underlying issues, there are underlying questions that need to be asked and that need to be understood. If a practitioner, whether or not we're talking about a therapist or a physician, is going to be able to get the full story. And unless they get the full story, you are not going to get the full benefits of visiting this doctor, this lawyer, this accountant, or this therapist. So again, there's been a lot of concern with substance abuse use with the older people. And I think in part, it has to do a lot with loneliness. I mean, we're really dealing, and there have been so many articles recently in the New York Times dealing with loneliness. But before we get to some of the loneliness research and, of course, what to do, how is your physical health? How are you doing physically? Are you basically okay? Are you basically in good health? And are you doing what you need to do, including getting, you know, complete physicals once a year, blood work, taking your doctor's advice if you're on medicine, not taking more than what is being prescribed? Are you willing to exercise, 30 minutes a day? There was a clip that my husband, Jim, showed me about Bobby Kennedy. And of course, Bobby Kennedy Jr. is running for president of the United States. And he was talking about his regime. Now, whether or not you are a Bobby Kennedy Jr. fan is really neither here nor there, but he is in amazing shape. And he was talking about his physical fitness regime, going to the gym every single day for, he talked about 35 minutes and lifting weights and, of course, having a trainer. Now, maybe we're not going to be able to do, or we're not going to be able to afford. Obviously, the coaches and professionals that a Bobby Kennedy Jr. would be able to have access to, but yet there are many, many things that we can do to keep ourselves in physical shape. And, it has to do with self-discipline and determination and, of course, good self-esteem and thinking about every day about all of the different things that we can do. Again, do, not just think about, not just dream about, to improve our health, to improve our relationships, to improve the quality of our life. And this all comes under the umbrella, really, of just self-care, making sure that the people you're surrounding yourself with, the ways that you're living, are really good for you. And that means eliminating toxicity, not just chemicals, but toxic people. And that may include family and friends who will always, toxicity will always hinder us from living a happy and balanced life. So when you ask yourself these questions, how is my mental health and how is my physical health and what are my relationships like and am I professionally in a place where I really would like to be, or perhaps I need to pivot, maybe even get out of the field that I've been in for many, many years, and my physical health, I mean, what are your answers? How are you actually doing? And this is a time to be honest. It is a truth time, not with me, but with yourself. And if you are finding that you are off in any one of the areas, that you may need to talk to somebody because the depression is really just taking over your life. Or if your relationships, you're looking at your family relationships, or you're looking at your romantic relationships, or your business relationships, and you're seeing, no, this is not good. This is not making me feel happy and good when I'm around these kinds of people. A couple of weeks ago, I was quoting some research by a Dr. Grant, who emphasize that it's not just the negative relationships that really strip us of our joy, but it's the ambivalent relationships. It's the roller coaster ride relationships where we never know from one day at a time what we are going to get. Are we going to get love, or are we going to get the opposite? And it's these kinds of crazy making relationships that I believe that we really need to find the strength to be able to exit. But as I was mentioning, all of the loneliness articles that are appearing in the New York Times, and there was something yesterday that I wanted to just review with you. The heading is Solving the Country's Loneliness Crisis Would Make Americans Healthier, Fitter, and Less Likely to Abuse Drugs. So here we have a national health advisory issued by the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who I have mentioned before, on May the 3rd, 2023, so this is very current, sheds light on the urgent public health issues of loneliness and isolation. And it is so important that we are talking about this. The report reflects Dr. Murthy's personal and professional experience with the damaging health impacts of loneliness. As surprising as it sounds, social isolation and loneliness have the same effect, and listen to this, on human health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, which is to say it can shorten life by up to 15 years. So let's look at the problems, you know, problem, solution, and then examine some of the solutions and what the nation, and of course, we're part of the nation, would gain by implementing them. So let's define the issue so that we're very, very clear. Loneliness and social isolation are widespread, and a 2021 survey by Cigna shows that nearly one in six Americans, and I've been reading that that number is much too high, that it's more like one in three Americans, reported feeling lonely or isolated. And that means that these conditions likely affect either you, yourself, or someone that you know. In the same survey, young adults were nearly twice as lucky or as likely as those over ages 65 to report feeling lonely or isolated. And I'm really experiencing that with some of the younger patients and actually some of the younger students that I have encountered. I think that people, especially during the pandemic, were housebound, and some people are still housebound because they're working from home. They're on their computers, they're not getting out, and they are feeling more and more and more isolated and lonely and disconnected. 75, these are statistics that I think are really important and serious to take in. 75% of Hispanics and 68% of Black or African American people reported these conditions. We're talking about the lonely and isolated feelings, as did a majority of lower income respondents and single parents. And while there are no definitive explanations for these high numbers, experts have suggested several possible determinants: the mobility of the population. I mean, we're moving all over the country, right? The shift from in-person to remote work and learning since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, I'm treating one young man in California who works for a bank, And he works from home and has never met his two teammates. His days start at 8 o'clock in the morning and they go upward till 6 o'clock. He is on the phone literally the entire time. And I asked him a couple of weeks ago, I said, well, why don't you Zoom? At least that would be a way of looking at someone and not just talking with someone on the phone. And for whatever reason, that is not what has been done with his, in quotes, team. So here he is in a room in California for 8 or 9 hours a day on the phone, never looking, never seeing anybody. And yes, he is feeling depressed and lonely and isolated and disconnected. And of course, we are working on a number of things that this young man needs to actually do to get himself out of his condo in California and begin to connect with people. So we have the mobility of the population, the shift to in-person, to remote work, and the deep divides in society caused by social media and irresponsible news sites. And this article goes on. It says that to grab the attention of viewers, some advertisers and media leaders understand that human beings are biased toward messages. And this was interesting to read that activate fear and loss. And in fact, there is a new term, a scientific term, aversion bias, demonstrates people are twice, and listen to this, twice as fearful of loss as happy for gain. That people are twice as fearful. They're scared. They're walking around just uptight and tense. They're twice as fearful of loss as happy for gain. And when we feel socially isolated and lonely, our vigilance for threat active act, really it activates our core survival instincts, which are rooted in evolutionary times. And for early humans, being accepted, and this is so important, and belonging to a group or community were key factors, key factors in survival. And being separated or ousted from one's tribe meant almost certain death. So what is that telling all of us about what we need to do? And thriving relationships became critical, not just past tense, but they are critical to human feelings of safety and well-being. In fact, longevity studies consistently find that the strength of one's lifelong relationships is the most important driver of a long and healthy life. So here we go. Relationships, relationships, healthy relationships. Look at what they do for us emotionally and physically and longevity-wise and psychologically and psychiatrically. This article goes on and is talking about stress, how stress and loneliness are also really connected. The human nervous system is balanced into two modes, right? The fight or flight of the sympathetic system and the rest and digest of the parasympathetic system. So here we have loneliness and isolation drive unbalanced activation. And this is science that we're talking about of the sympathetic nervous system leading to hypervigilance or scanning the environment for threats. And once this threat response is activated, people see their environment as unsafe, leading to release of hormones that interfere with our trust and pleasure response. And these are some of the very, very real and serious effects of loneliness and isolation. And as this stress response heightens, people experience surges in hormones that elevate their heart rate and blood pressure. And I'm sure that many of you can really relate to this. And over time, the release of these hormones damage our blood vessels, our heart, our brain. So it's not just our emotional and our psychological and our psychiatric well-being. We're talking about what happens as a result of the loneliness and isolation and how this really damages our body, our blood vessels, our heart, our brain, our blood, our liver, and our metabolic and musculoskeletal systems. Much like a car, the engine that is continually over-revved, our body's symptoms begin to break down, and our perceived experience of pain is heightened. And again, I'm sure that many of you, unfortunately, can relate to this. And what else happens with our loneliness and our isolation? Well, there's an increase in feelings of worthlessness, and fear increases the risk of substance abuse, absolutely, mental health challenges, and a variety of chronic diseases and obesity, all of which can contribute and do contribute to a reduced lifespan. So what are we saying here? You know, in other words, loneliness and isolation drive disease and shorten lifespans through unbalanced activation of the sympathetic nervous system induced by the perception of threat and chronic stress. Okay, so again, what are you going to do if you've been feeling for a short term or for a long term, you know, feelings of isolation and disconnect? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I think that it is so important. It requires us to work together in community to really make some positive differences. And this means really getting out of our comfort zone. I mean, I'll hear people say to me all the time, you know, at the end of the day, I'm tired. I don't feel like going out. I should go out and meet somebody, but you know, I think I'm going to watch Netflix. I mean, this is absolutely not the way that we are going to resolve our feelings of disconnect and isolation and loneliness. And yes, it means pushing ourselves out of a comfort zone that really, really doesn't work. You know, I gave a presentation this past weekend at the East Hampton Library in East Hampton, and the subject was online dating. So the topic was, should I swipe right or left or maybe not at all? And it was really interesting. There was a lovely, lovely group of women, and there were two men. One was my husband, who was there as my support and champion. And then there was another man who arrived really halfway through the presentation. Now, some of the women were talking about their very frustrating and very disappointing experiences up to this point that they were having online. So, you know, I asked these women, well, did you get to a point where you actually met the man in person? And most did not. But what was really fascinating to me is that even though they were, you know, going back and forth online, and yes, there was a match, the majority of women said that they didn't even speak to the people on the phone or Zoom to see whether or not there could be a potential connection. And like, what is that about? If there is a match, why would you not want to Zoom and see if there was some kind of spark, physical spark or physical attraction, and have a face-to-face, granted, it wouldn't be in person, but it would be a face-to-face interaction. And these women were saying, yeah, I think maybe you're right. Maybe we need to at least, you know, find a way to look at the person and then decide whether or not we wanted perhaps to, you know, to get together for a cup of coffee. But there are so many different venues where we can meet people over and above online dating. The research suggests, and these women, they were also very surprised to hear this, and I actually was surprised when I had read this number as well, that it's just 14% of people are ending up in meaningful relationships, I suppose, meaningful meaning long-term or marriage-type relationships. And I think that we've forgotten there's a whole other world out there. There are events, there are book signings, there are lectures, there are political involvements that you can get yourself really attached to and involved in. I mean, there's going to be a presidential, there is a presidential, you know, campaign that's starting, you know, various different people are now running for president. What a great way to meet people through volunteering. And I think that we have forgotten some of these very, very basic ways that we always in the past met people. We were not married to our phones and we were not married to our devices. We would go out. And, you know, one of the things that I was discussing at the event at the library was that, you know, for example, people are walking down the street or people are out for dinner or lunch or even at the gym and they are on their devices. And the women, they were laughing because I asked them, I said, you know, how much time, how many hours do you spend on your devices? And research is showing that people are spending anywhere from 7 to 9 hours every single day looking at your phone. And this is a reminder for me too. I really, really do need to, you know, put the phone away. I can rationalize and I can say, well, I need to hear from my patients and maybe there's going to be a cancellation. But I know for myself, I am really looking at my phone way too much and I need to actually do something about it. But what is the message? What are some of the messages that we are giving to the world out there when we are busily on our phones? I haven't gone to a gym in a couple of years. I have my treadmill and I have my weights here at our apartment. But I remember it was a great way. It was a really, really great way to interact with people. And I remember before the pandemic, I had gone to the gym and people were plugged in. So everybody, they were on their treadmills, they were doing their exercises and they were plugged in, which for me was a very, very, very clear message. And what was the message? The message was stay away. And is that the message when we are out and about in our lives? Is that really the message that we want to be communicating to people, to stay away? And, you know, one of the other things that we were talking about at the East Hampton Library presentation was, you know, how are we projecting generally? Do we smile? I mean, yes, we have to be careful, and yes, we know that there's crime, but are we friendly? I mean, you can meet people virtually anywhere. But it depends on, you know, what are you and are you aware of how you are coming across and what you are projecting to the outside world? And I think that these are things that we all have to really think about because it either aids in our connection or it takes away from our being able to connect and it adds to our feelings of loneliness and alienation and disconnect. So yes, as a therapist and also as the, you know, host of the Ask Beanie Show, I know that I'm asking the tough, tough questions, but these are really important questions that all of us really need to answer. Well, there was a piece that has nothing to do with loneliness at all in the New York Times about our former mayor. Bill de Blasio. And the headline was, finally, Bill de Blasio wins New Yorkers' praise for his breakup, well, with his wife. Many New Yorkers weren't impressed with Bill de Blasio as mayor, but the way he's handling his separation from his wife, Charlene McRae, is very inspiring. So I don't know whether or not you've been keeping up with this story. But as a two-term Democratic mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio earned mixed reviews at best. But now that he's out of office, he's getting rave reviews for the way he is handling an unexpected development, his separation from his wife, and the transformation of their marriage. So I quote, last week, Bill de Blasio and his wife, Charlene McRae, announced in the Times that they were going to start dating other people while still living together in their Park Slope, that's Brooklyn Row House. It was an unexpected moment, both transparency and ambiguity, that transfixed many New Yorkers. The couple, at least as of last week, did not plan to divorce, they said, though they didn't rule it out. And one of them may move out eventually or not. And they left that door open. And so everybody, or a lot of marriage therapists and advice columnists and people, are talking about how they are very, very in awe of how the de Blasios are handling their situation. And, you know, some quotes, their desire to not see marriage in strictly binary terms is either monogamy or divorce was also both very much of the moment, very much in the moment. And so many, many people, in fact, everybody in this article were extremely impressed with the fact that this couple, that they could perhaps separate, and at the same time, they could still be together, so that their new arrangement, you know, meant that they would be able to preserve many aspects of their 29-year marriage. For example, I mean, we don't know the ins and outs, but their finances, their shared family home with their two growing children, their friendship, even though, and this was Bill de Blasio's words, even though they knew something, which was the lovey-dovey feeling, was missing. And then there was a quote, but I want to go back to this lovey-dovey feeling, because everybody knew that when the de Blasios, when they married, his wife had come out as a lesbian, you know, marrying her spouse. So that was interesting. And I mean, if she was a lesbian, I mean, maybe she was also bisexual. I mean, after all, they had two children. I would think that there would have been some, in quotes, sexual issues that would have occurred as a result of you know, her coming out as gay. And how interesting too that you know, Bill de Blasio, again, there's no judgment, just, you know, some interesting questions would have agreed. I mean, maybe sex for him at that point wasn't important. I mean, who knows what their sex life was like, even though she, you know, was out as a lesbian. You know, how much over the years that actually impacted their relationship. But there was a quote here by a very well-known relationship, so-called relationship expert and author, columnist, and his name is Dan Savage. And this is what he said. This is exactly what he said. He says, well, he said their relationship is very much mirroring his own. And he is gay. And he said that in his own life, he practices a type of hierarchical polyamory in which he and his husband, this is Dan Savage's quote, Dan Savage's husband of nearly 30 years, each have a long-term boyfriend while keeping their marriage bond primary. And again, all the quotes from different counselors. I don't know why I was not, you know, contacted to comment on all of this. We're very much supportive of the arrangement that Bill de Blasio and his wife now have. Now, how this is going to work out long term, that really remains to be seen. And maybe their bond is so very, very solid. And because of the sexual, let's just say the lovey-dovey or the lack of lovey-dovey feelings, maybe that's going to work, where each will be able to go out and find sexually satisfying relationships. And then, of course, if they both or one or both end up not only finding a sexually satisfying relationship, but also find an emotionally, you know, strong, an intellectually strong connection with the newfound sexual connection, I would suspect then that this arrangement would probably change. You know, a lot of the people who were quoted, these were mostly New York people, and they were saying that, you know, people are needing to be, you know, really open about new family forms, and that people are reimagining different kinds of family structures, because in fact, there really are a lot of options. But each of us, though, we need to figure out what kind of a family option would work for us. And I can tell you something absolutely, absolutely sure from my own personal experience. This kind of an arrangement for Bidi Confredos, and my husband isn't here in the room right now, but I would say that this kind of an arrangement would absolutely, absolutely not work for us. So every single couple, we need to know what would work, what would not work. We need to be willing to communicate all of this. And I mean, I wish Bill de Blasio and his wife, Charlene, you know, all the best. And I think it took a lot of courage for them to come out. I think, you know, sooner or later, people were going to find out, certainly in New York, that they were, you know, not married in the same way that they had been married for all of these years. And Charlene had said that the political pressures, you know, really had an impact on their marriage. And I frankly, you know, I really wish them the best. And I think that it's a good thing. I think that it's a really, really good thing that we are all willing to talk about different kinds of relationships, about different kinds of marriages. And the conversation is a really, really important conversation. First, the conversation really needs to be had with ourselves. You know, what would work? What would work for me? What would I be comfortable with? And if you were dating someone, or even if you were in a long-term relationship or a marriage, and this kind of thing comes up a lot. It comes up a lot that people need to be willing to really talk about it and explore where their relationships are at, and explore you know, really possible options. You know, Dan Savage, his comment was, and you know, to a degree, I think he's right. He says that this was the quote. He said that after 3 decades,
into a marriage, almost all marriages at that point are companionate, you know, more companions and not lovey-dovey. And I think that that's something that couples need to be aware of so that they are not going to let their sex lives go, and how important it is in marriages and in long-term relationships and in short-term relationships that we try to do whatever it is that we can do to really keep the sizzle in our relationships. Well, I have so many other things that I wanted to talk about, but we'll talk about it next week. And again, I want to thank you all so much for tuning in. I know that there are a lot of other things that people can be doing every single day, you know, from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. And I really do. I appreciate your emails. I appreciate your comments. I do wish you would call me. So maybe next week, some of you will think about actually picking up the phone. And I want to leave you with my 2 weekly messages. The first is that I want you to continue to do everything that you can possibly do to love yourself and live your life authentically in ways that are in your best interest. And secondly, we all need to do, of course, a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other and respect each other, despite our differences, our political differences, our personal differences. And that's the way that we're going to be able to create a much, much, much better world. So again, thank you so much for being here with me, and have a good, good rest of the day and a great week. And I will talk with you next week. So goodbye, everybody, and take care.